where they're trying to take all of the past international presidents. We were very fortunate. We lost the first president, international president, within the past year, and they had just taped it before Judge Lenore D. Underwood. It was a fascinating tape. But see, we were lucky. Because that's what I keep telling the girls here about a few people that should be taped for national here, but if they don't do it now, you know.
I understand that the woman who's head of your oral history program came from council.
Who?
I don't know the name, but some...
You mean nationally?
The council was proposing to tape and discussing it, and they could not get hold of the people from Pittsburgh who had done the book. So it was tabled, and this person who was someone at the meeting went to B'nai B'rith with the proposal, and they grabbed her up.
I don't know. I was telling Natalie that the fascinating thing was that we didn't know it and they didn't know it. The same time we started our program here, calling it by a different name, our women in Australia began a program called Lest We Forget, and it's the same identical thing. And neither we didn't know.
Well, you know, I have been most impressed. And so I think, as you said before, people get their own motivations for becoming interested in something. And my interest in B'nai B'rith, the reason I have worked with the Jewish Family and Children's Service in the Aged Department, and I really was very impressed with B'nai B'rith when they put forward the news on this.
That's a fascinating program.
Yeah, and Nancy
if
tried
I could
so
tell you about
hard.
Some of the people they attracted, though, was so funny. I won't mention names, but there's a very wealthy lady in this town who's always belonged to B'nai B'rith women, and she, you know, is generous when it comes donor time, but has never done anything. This, of all the things in the world, she's never come to meetings or... This appealed to her, and I think she's either driving or delivering. I don't know what she's doing, but she's involved.
It is such a... Of course, I saw from the other angle, and it's such a need to have something like this. And B'nai B'rith group was the one group of women who really took hold. And
I'm delighted that they did, because I don't have to tell you today. It's so hard to get women to attach themselves to anything where they have to go out and do anything. Mm-hmm. Anything.
I'd like to ask you... I guess you're willing to start. Are you starting on the
Yeah, it's on.
I was interested. Are there many young women now active in B'nai B'rith? Are you interested? You felt something about
wanting
young women.
Our main concern is, one of the main concerns in membership is the development of chapters with very young women. Now, it moved from community to community in different ways. There are still communities where, like the sisterhood, seem to be the only ones able to take across-the-board age with no problem. Mm-hmm. Most other Jewish women's organizations have problems with that because the young people want to be by themselves, just as when we created our that first chapter, Menorah, after the one that was here. We lived through some bitter times with the other chapter, fighting each other. Mm-hmm. And I once remember, after a number of years have passed, I said to them, don't be so angry at us because we call you the older women. One of these days you'll laugh when we're being called the older women, which we are. We've lived to that day. So depending on the community, we try very hard to develop young women's units. There are some communities where they have lots of young women. There are other communities where we don't attract them. It's different. And just as you find with council, every organization has a different status in a different community. Mm-hmm. In one community, one organization's top of the heap. In another community, another one. And I found that in traveling, that there's no set... When someone says, oh, ORT is the organization, you say, what community? Because you'll find one community it is, another community may not be. And it has a lot to do with what they're doing at the time. I know that I can say honestly, because I think it's true of all organizations, we've been on every level, top, middle, bottom, and we keep moving, depending on the leadership, on the mood of the times, and whether you're attracting young people. Now, we have just chartered a young group, lovely young women, and this is going to be our thrust to organize as many as possible, because... as I said before, keeping women like me active, there's no future in it. Absolutely none.
This group of young women are rare.
I find that they're all professional women. They're teachers. But I find that most of them live in the suburbs. And I think that's where tomorrow has to be.
Okay.
Now, you have a large Jewish community right here in Oakland, but who are they? They are women who either have always belonged to the Jewish organizations, or they never did, and it's hopeless. So this is not the area where you go. The suburbs are the future, definitely. And Pittsburgh, in that sense, Pittsburgh has always been a little behind in building, in developing suburbs, and organizing in suburbs, but I think we're there now.
Is there any means, I know in Mount Lebanon specifically, you've had, what, three separate chapters, all of whom were having trouble with leadership.
One is a group, the young kids. There's a group of very, very young women, and I mean very young, and they're in great shape. But the South Hills chapter is an old chapter. The Eden chapter has been in existence a long time. I must tell you one thing about B'nai B'rith and B'nai B'rith women. They are national leaders, and I don't mean of B'nai B'rith, of Jewish community life. Always point to B'nai B'rith as the spawning ground of leadership throughout the country in this sense. You can name almost anybody in most communities who's gone places, either in other organizations or in her personal, professional life, and you'll find out she started out in B'nai B'rith. Now, that's not 100%, but enough so that we find that to be very commonplace. When I was the international president, there was a NACRAC meeting here, NCRAC meeting here in Pittsburgh. Now, that's the National Community Relations groups throughout the country and Canada were here. And I was then president, and David Blumberg, the president of the men, came in, and there was a reception in our honor. As we were greeting the people coming through the line, we greeted all kinds of people from all kinds of organizations and leadership and professional positions. And in many cases where we didn't know them, they'd say, oh, you don't know me, but I used to be active in such and such a lodge, or I was this in B'nai B'rith, and it's very interesting. And we find that with our own women, don't you, in council? Find that you have women who have been active in the group, and then suddenly they take a job in the community. And an important job, and they've really felt their oats in what they have learned through their organizational life.
Has the relationship changed between men's B'nai B'rith and women's over the years?
Oh, sure. We were auxiliaries originally. They didn't even want us, and because there were people like the late Lillian S. Davis of Pittsburgh who pressed and pressed and pressed, finally they permitted us to become auxiliaries. And through the years, many years, we were really functioning under their support, financial and otherwise. And then we reached a point where we became the Women's Supreme Council and then B'nai B'rith Women International, where we stand on our own feet and we not only raise our own money, but we turn over about $1.5 million to the men.
And you said the meeting you were at in Washington was men's board,
yeah,
that you sit on the committee.
The men's board of governors is the top, other than the small administrator, like the executive committee of that group, that is the top ruling body of B'nai B'rith. And sitting on there are just a limited number of women. I think they're including the president of B'nai B'rith Women, about 7. And they are elected. And they are either past presidents of B'nai B'rith Women International or are officers.
Are most of the international presidents American women?
All of them. We haven't even had a Canadian. And Canadian B'nai B'rith women are now moving to become B'nai B'rith Women of Canada. Strong nationalism there.
I'm curious again about the beginning. You said it was an elitist group and the men met in tuxedos.
That was overseas. And here too, way, way back, you see it was a fraternal organization in the full sense, and they had their rituals and so forth, and it was very formal, and you found that very, very distinguished, important people belonged.
Was it, I would guess in the timing in 1845, that it was primarily German Jewish?
Mm-hmm. Yes. At that time they were formed, as I remember, because of the kinds of things that were happening with the Jew and what his position was at that time in the American Jewish community, in the American community, and so forth. But you see, it's an organization that is ever-changing precisely because it doesn't have a single program. It has always geared itself to meet the needs of the times. And there have been many things that were started by B'nai B'rith and turned over. The National Jewish Hospital in Denver was opened by B'nai B'rith, but it was turned over to the community or the country, whatever, at a point where it was on its feet. Leo and Levy Memorial Hospital in Hot Springs, Arkansas, where B'nai B'rith still plays a very big role, but it was opened by B'nai B'rith, and they get token support from B'nai B'rith now. In Cleveland, there's the Belfair for Emotionally Disturbed Children.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was opened right after the Civil War by B'nai B'rith for orphans of Jewish men who were killed during the Civil War. It now treats emotionally disturbed children, and it gets a token support from B'nai B'rith, but it was turned over to the community. And then there are institutions, community things like old age homes, that most of them are either not in existence or turned over to the community. But B'nai B'rith has been instrumental in beginning these things and developing these things, but they take the position that, for example, I think perhaps to both of you, the most vivid example would be Hillel. Hillel, which was carried for almost, well, at least 40 years or more, strictly by B'nai B'rith, a very costly project. You know, the salaries of the rabbi directors, the institutions, and so forth. And at a certain point, it was felt that this is not right. That while this organization initiated it, developed it, supported it, and still has all the know-how and should stay in, and it should still be known as B'nai B'rith Hillel, we're serving the Jewish youth of the country. And the federations who take the largest amount of money out of the community should be sharing some of that cost. No single organization could afford it. Others tried. I might tell you that the Reformed Jewish movement was interested in Hillel. Other Jewish movements were interested. Nobody could afford it. It's impossible. And so while it remains B'nai B'rith Hillel, and we provide all the expertise and the know-how and the staffing, the federation, in many, many communities, federations are giving more money than B'nai B'rith. But that's as it should be, because the percentage of support to B'nai B'rith wouldn't permit this kind of thing. So that's the nature of the organization, and that's what permits it to change. In other words, if, for example, in the foreseeable future, something should arise in the Jewish community where B'nai B'rith thinks this is the thing it ought to do, and we're constantly being handed new projects, and it's heartrending now, because now almost every Jewish organization today is in a position where it has to say no. It has to say, we must support what we have adequately. We can't keep reaching out to take more, because as long as this inflation lasts, every organization is going to be in this kind of situation.
I was curious, is there a predominant branch of Judaism that supports B'nai B'rith?
No, a couple of studies they've made indicated that probably it's weighted heavily in the middle, conservative. But actually, it's an organization, and that's one of the things that's unique about B'nai B'rith, that it always claimed and did live to the standard that B'nai B'rith has a platform large enough to carry Jews of every walk of life, rich or poor, Orthodox, conservative, Reformed, Reconstructionist, Zionist, non-Zionist. In other words, if you're Jewish, you have a place there. You may not agree with the mainstream, but you have a place there. And pretty much it has stayed that way through the years. And it's interesting, too, that we were sued. ADL, was it ADL? No, it was B'nai B'rith that was sued, because we won't take non-Jews to court. The case was thrown out of court. But every once in a while, somebody gets a bright idea that, you know, when they want to get even with you for something ADL has done and so forth, mm-hmm. on civil rights or human rights, and so they'll come after us on the basis that we're discriminating, too.
And a non-Jewish person cannot join?
No. Of course, it's a sectarian organization, just as a sisterhood.
Where does B'nai B'rith have it? Is it universal, or... is it more attractive to people in larger communities? Or
no.
I think of small towns
no.
and large places.
No, it's
you know,
interesting.
Where would it be? In,
you know what one of
president?
Our greatest strengths is and why, for example, when there is an issue that we have to do something about in the Jewish community, mm-hmm. the Conference of Presidents, that's the organization, the umbrella organization
the major,
for all the major Jewish organizations, and I sat on that while I was president. They'll always reach to B'nai B'rith because we're the only organization that's organized all over the world in large communities and small
mm-hmm.
communities. And if there is a need to make contact in 24 hours
mm-hmm.
with a constituency to get letters or whatever, and it's urgent, we have a way to reach out to all these little tiny communities like Jonesboro, Arkansas, where we have 12 members in the chapter. And went to a convention once, and 12 members, they must have had 6 delegates. So I said, isn't that marvelous? And she said, well, yes, I'd like you to meet my mother, my aunt, my sister.
That's great.
And you know, Jonesboro, Arkansas, I wrote a letter in my president's column at the time about, you know, the magnificence of this. It was great. And somebody wrote back and said, if you think that that's the only thing we do, I don't know why that's so great. We also support a synagogue. But that's the beauty of it. In fact, in many things, we're very useful. We have a prominent representative at the UN, and we're very useful very often because the Israeli embassies and countries very often can get information through our UN man here faster than they can get from their own sources. But being organized that way in so many places, large and small, gives us a distinct advantage. And I must tell you a very exciting thing that happened. Right after the Yom Kippur War, I was president, and there was a great big conference held in Washington, D.C., of the Conference of Presidents, and all the leaders came in, and Senator Kennedy spoke, and Senator Schweiker spoke, and it was television and radio all over the place. And I was at the head table. Never could find anybody around that saw me on TV. But you know where I got letters from? Israel. They said, we saw you on TV, and while our hearts were very heavy, you can't know how encouraged we were because we saw you sitting there. See, to them, that was a symbol. We were involved, and we were going to help. But it was interesting that locally, nobody saw it, but in Israel, they saw it. And these are some of the things that get to them, you know, when they're in despair, that they know they have a lifeline.
Is there any other Jewish organization that has their own representative at the UN?
There are what they call the NGOs, national non-governmental organizations. In other words, I don't know how the arrangement works exactly, but there are representatives to the UN in this non-governmental organization situation. And you know, within the past 3 or 4 years, there was a very serious attempt to throw B'nai B'rith out. And, you know, the great concern was not only that they'd throw B'nai B'rith out, but once they got B'nai B'rith out, the others would go, and there was a huge fight. And, you know, you politician, and you get the one person to talk. Much of the work at the UN is not done at the big meeting. They're done on the corridors talking to people. And we won. But it was a hard-fought fight, and it preserved not only our position, but the other organizations that are represented there.
Who instigated the...
Well, it came from the third world countries. Remember this, Russia would love to get us out. My husband and I... it was my husband. What was it that somebody gave me, and I have it put away someplace, a piece from a Russian newspaper? See, our Dr. William Corey, who now is the... executive for our B'nai B'rith International Council, who was head of this UN, he still remains a UN representative.
Mm-hmm.
He's holding both jobs. He's Russian-speaking. He's brilliant. And he will often pick up different things that he will give to us. And I got hold of this piece that was from the Russian newspaper where they were talking. They were trying to slander some of the people on some issue here in the United States. And listed among the people, it mentioned B'nai B'rith, and then it listed some names, and it had Mr. Nathan Holstein, wealthy industrialist. Everybody was listed as a wealthy industrialist. So I showed it to Nate, and I said, well, that's as close you're going to get to being a wealthy industrialist. That paper I've kept, and I have put away. just a shame my father-in-law, Oliver Shaw, never lived to see it, because he read the Jewish foreword like it was a Bible. When I became president, my picture was in the foreword. And I'll never forget, Rabbi Jay Kaufman was then the executive vice president, the director of B'nai B'rith, and he clipped it out too and sent it to me, because I wouldn't have seen it. A friend sent it, and he did. And he said, you always told me about your father and his favorite paper. He would have loved to see that you finally made the paper.
It's been hard to mobilize people, though, at the UN at that time. You know, you have to know your resources.
You'd be amazed at the things the non-governmental agencies can do, and you'd be amazed at how many people, and that doesn't go into a book either, for protection of the Jewish community, how many people will come to our Dr. Corey, how many foreign representatives there come to him for information and for details and for knowledge. And very often they come to tell you, look, I know that we had to vote this way, but you understand it isn't because we're against Israel. See, what we it's horrible, but you have to understand that some of these little countries will sell a vote just to get the money. You know, they shouldn't even be there. They have no money, they have no clout, they have nothing. And if you took the oil away from them, they go out of existence. So they vote according to what keeps them alive. That's what France just did. France is 100% dependent on oil, and what they did was absolutely the worst. They sold themselves. On the other hand, people who in the know will say to you, it is horribly wrong, but stop and think, what would the United States do if we were 100% dependent on oil?
I think what was most frightening was what if Israel had gotten him. The reprisals would have been...
Well, that's what Germany was afraid of. That's what
I would have liked to have seen Germany get it.
They didn't really want them. Mm-hmm. They too were scared to death. It's in this week's Newsweek. Mm-hmm. They called the shots. They said Germany didn't really want them, and neither did France want them, because they're scared to death. But the terrorists would do to them, to them, you know, the kinds of things that would happen. It's very frightening. The whole world seems very frightening. I made a statement to Steve and Ida, my children, yesterday. My husband and I had brunch there, and I said, you know, I know how dependent some of these countries are on oil, and it's a terrible thing, and you can't treat it lightly. But I said, doesn't it have to be like a human being, where you feel you have to give and you have to give, and yet you reach a point where you say, this is it, no more. If I die, I die, but no more. And shouldn't a country be that way? And the answer I got was sort of a quizzical. Well, how do you don't know? I say it. That's frank idealism, I suppose. But I really believe that if something doesn't change, what kind of world would it be if everybody has to sell out for one thing? And look, it's so bold and brazen. They just got rid of him. The next day they announced the big sale they made. Mm-hmm. And now he's over there shopping in Saudi Arabia. No attempt. I think if I were the president of France, I'd try to cover a little bit. I would be embarrassed. And see, that's not the people's will. That's another thing. You know, my husband has a large family in France. Mm-hmm. And you get to know it's not only France. It's they claim that's true in Israel, too. I was reading an article just within the last few days that it's very important that the government represent the people, and in all too many instances the government is not elected the way we elect, and so there's no indication what the people want.
Well, so many instances here we may have elected them, but how much are they doing what the people want?
But we have access to them. If people will try, those senators and congressmen, they read that mail. And their influence, the problem is most people don't write. It's as simple as that. But you have to use the weight of your opinion where you can. And we can.
Yeah, this seems clear to me now, hearing her talk about what happened in the UN. You know, if you want something badly enough, and work, have to know how to do it.
You have to know
the people and know how, and have the desire.
Well, for example, how many letters have you seen? Look, I'm now among the guilty ones. I think I have an excuse. I'm tempted every time, but to keep sitting down to write letters to the editor, I I'm drowning in all this kind of stuff. But really, I've been watching. It should have been 100 letters to the editor on the subject of what France did. I didn't see many.
Hmm.
And I don't buy it when it appears in the Chronicle. You see, I see things in the Chronicle and I think they're great and I want to know why they're not in the press. Mm-hmm. And our people react. I use this a lot when I speak because I feel it. People can do anything they want. Women can do anything they want to do when they want to do it. But if they don't want to do it, you know, they can go down to see a play if there's 12 feet of snow. And they don't even wear boots. Park Chenley the other night, I think I was the only woman with boots. Mm-hmm. Nobody's afraid. Weather doesn't stop them. Go to a meeting. It may rain tomorrow. I don't think I'll go. It's as simple as that. It depends on what you want to do. If a woman doesn't want to go to a meeting, 4 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, it's Erev Yom Tov. And excuses, there are plenty. And I believe that women have been derelict. They could do a heck of a lot more. They don't write letters. Well, I'll tell you what they're good at. Sitting around the table playing cards and complaining. What good does that do? It's nice to complain to each other, but do they complain where it all... Women are... I'm disappointed. It's because at this particular stage I am. Because I have great faith in women, and I think women can do anything they want. And I'm disappointed that they don't do more, that they don't fight. Why is the coffee boycott dead in Pittsburgh and alive elsewhere? What's the matter with our women? You don't die from not... I may like coffee, but we're not going to die from not drinking it. We may live longer if we don't drink it. But I see a lot of things that don't happen, and I think, why? You know, the old me that I told you about initially was a quiet, introverted, shy gal.
That's right.
That part of me never really left. There was a facade that reached over it, and I seemed very outgoing. There's a part of that old girl left in me, but one part of it I've just destroyed in the last 3 or 4 years. I was the kind of person that if I went into town and I was cheated, I didn't say anything. I was embarrassed. I kept quiet. I wouldn't make a ruckus. I call every single shot now. I will not be bilked any longer. And they're not going to send... I talked to the president of every department, so I won't talk to anybody else. And you know what? It's very sad, girls. It works. It's very sad that I get upstairs to that president or his secretary or an assistant, and everything I'm complaining about gets taken care of. I am tired of being pushed around. I am tired of being cheated. I'm tired of being asked to pay 10 times as much. I know I have to pay it, but give me the same merchandise I got for 10 times less. Don't give me inferior merchandise. There's so many things, and you know, I get no cooperation. Everybody says, oh, Lil, what are you complaining about? Or they say, oh, Lil, you know you can't do anything about it. We've become a very permissive society.
Going back to what you had said about being shy, because I remember you were saying this about being shy and introverted.
Never opened my mouth all the way through school till I got to college.
Where did you get the guts to do these things? What motivated you? Plus being lonely, you said
no,
you were lonely.
No, it wasn't
thing.
Motivation. I find that, and many of us are this way, when I'm thrown into a situation, I cope with it. See, I was thrown into it, so I cope.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not come from a quiet family.
Mm-hmm.
My late brother and I, and my sister too, we could take either side of the subject and we could go to town. And my brother
mm-hmm.
was innately shy.
Mm-hmm.
We walk into a room, it was very hard for him to greet everybody. He was a big, good-looking redhead. He looked just like Spencer Tracy, a dead ringer for him. And yet I knew, but those of us close to him knew, he sounded gruff all the time. And we knew he was shy. But get him into a conversation and...
Was your husband interested in your doing this sort of thing? Did he...
He initially really moved me into it. I don't think he ever bargained for that.
But he has been supportive.
He's been most supportive. Unhappy with it,
mm-hmm.
particularly in recent years because he's lonely, but very supportive. He could be just as upset as possible about my doing it and being difficult, but when the chips were down, he supported me.
But there was never
very proud of me. Yeah.
There wasn't the kind of thing where you felt guilty because you were going.
Sometimes I did, yeah. Particularly when he was alone. Because I knew he was doing it for me. He wanted me to be happy. And I knew it was a sacrifice because he doesn't like to be alone. We can sit here for hours and maybe not talk. We can both be reading. We like being together, and he misses. I'll sometimes scold and say, you know, he'll fall asleep, and when he wakes up from his nap, I'll say, now what did...